to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two, and I just actually heard from, I've been trying to reach David Harrison, your NHC winner, and he got home, and he's a little knocked out, and he got a little sick, and I can imagine, I mean, when you are chasing that contest, and you barely sleep, your nerves are fried, that's not surprising. So he's been under the weather all week. So we'll get him next week. We'll get our, as I call it, the exit interview, the post victory lap, as it were. So, but he's okay. I hear Tony in the background. Tony, as I get to you, I do want to slip one thing in. And, I don't know if you heard, of course, yesterday when we had Ray Handel, the big response, the Jose Mejia Fund has already raised close to $40,000 in basically 36 hours. Well, I saw that Davey Cohen, and I really should reach out to David, Davey circulating a fund as well. Eric Gary, who's an assistant trainer, his wife Lindsay was in a very bad car accident, and she is in a coma. But is when I read yesterday, she's responding, to stimulus but a horrific accident in I want to say Lexington. And Davey and his wife, they're obviously very friendly with Eric and with Lindsay, and put together a fund. And it's raised $30,000 in 2 days as well. And this is, like I said yesterday to Ray, things aren't tough enough doing this, the way everybody works. And Tony Black can certainly appreciate it. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. You know, in the history of this sport, I've seen these type of actions transpire over the years, but not as of recent. You know, it used to be, when I was first around the racetrack, I was a little kid in the 50s and 60s and started riding in the 70s. You used to see racetracks and these racetrackers really stick together and pick each other up when they were downtrodden and facing adverse situations and health situations. But it's so refreshing and so rewarding to see in this modern day and age that racetrackers still have that camaraderie, that desire to help each other when they're down and out. So I wasn't aware of the fund that David Cohen had put together. I was aware of the other fund. And, it's people need help. When it comes to these types of situations, they just need help. And I can't say enough how rewarding it is personally and how rewarding it is to see the industry stick together and do things of this nature. I'm just going to go out back because my little girl just started yelling.
That's all right. That's all right.
But it is reward. It's really it's really heartfelt to see situations like this come about.
Well, and Tony, it's one thing. I don't want to parse out, and I shouldn't make a blanket statement on this front, but certainly, you know, jocks that ride in the afternoon have at least the potential to have had, you know, an income, you know, an income stream that allows them, you know, to have at least some security and at least have a slightly, you know, potentially a nest egg or something to fall back on, depending on their age and how long they, you know, and how responsible. I mean, you look at somebody like Ramon Dominguez when Ramon's career was cut short. I mean, he had another, whatever, 15 years easily or 20 to ride. But, you know, Ramon, I'd see Ramon pull into the racetrack in a Toyota Corolla. I mean, he wasn't spending six figures on sports cars. Ramon had a little different approach. When you think about somebody like a Jose Mejia, who's an exercise rider and a foreman, he hasn't had the opportunity to salt away, stakes winnings and some fat checks that you take a good chunk off of and put away in safe keeping in some sort of an investment or whatever.
Yeah, he hasn't had the opportunity to have those six-figure earnings over the years. I mean, and he's worked as hard as any jock has ever worked that has earned that kind of money. Absolutely. When you're an exercise rider, believe me, and when you're a stable foreman or assistant trainer, you're working hard because you're taking a lot of the pressure off of the trainer or the person that has to be there 7 days a week that might be able to come 5 or 6 days a week because you're there. But most of the time, those guys are there 6 and 7 days a week. They're working their butts off. And exercise riders, let me explain something. The better you are, the more risk you take. It isn't, I'm so good as an exercise rider, I'm never going to get hurt. No. You get the reputation as an exercise rider, man, this guy's really good. And he winds up getting called on to get on every horse that's maybe got a problem of getting around there, you know, because you're so good. Where a jock at times can say, no, I don't want to ride that horse. He has too many idiosyncrasies. He's not the kind of horse that I have confidence in, so I'll duck him. You know, exercise rider, his more ability he has and the greater his reputation is, the more he's called on to get on what is considered the bad one, you know. So his risks are as high as any jock's risk. And I was glad to see just a few weeks ago when we talked about California, how they're going to certify these exercise riders, and they're going to provide some kind of, a program for them to get involved in, where they're not only just physically capable, but they're also there'll be some benefits that probably along the way will be provided. It's a tough game. Sometimes, you know, in other businesses, the better you are, the least amount of risk you take. The better you are in this business, a lot of times, the higher the risk level is. But it's so good to see the racetrackers stick together and, you know, really reach out and try to help someone that is needing of help. Now, with jockeys, of course, you know, you touched on responsibility. You know, how responsible you are really plays into it. If you're going to be able to continue a lifestyle that you're used to when you're not able to ride any longer. As Ramon, you know, He was a person that was business orientated, saved money, put himself into a situation, I'm sure, that his future after riding ended, even though it ended like sooner than what anybody expected because of injury. He put himself in a position where he could go on and handle an adverse situation as he's handled. But so many riders, I mean, I rode good riders over the years that were at the end of their career and they didn't have anything to show for their future. And that was generally the way you thought of a lot of the older riders that I rode with in the 70s that started riding in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. By the 70s, they're at the end of their game, and they're looking to replace their livelihood with some kind of job that will give them some income, because they're looking at no savings or weren't business-wise enough to think this is going to end someday. And, you know, so many of the people along the way would say, listen, take advantage of what you're earning now, because it's going to end someday. You can tell that to a kid that's 20 or 30 years old. Well, you're not a kid when you're 30. And they don't, as much as they know it's going to end someday, the reality of it and what you're faced with when it ends doesn't set in. It doesn't even affect you in a minimal way to a lot of times where guys really took care of their future by taking care of their present income. It's a tough business. And we're not talking about highly educated people. When I listen to, when I get out of college, I'm going to be replaced. I'm going to be placed someplace in the racing industry. That is really an admirable situation that most of these guys, it's when they get out of high school, and a whole lot of them, it isn't even getting out of high school. I was reading an article, about a jock that had a lot of success, I can mention his name because I rode with him. And the article that was written about Vernon Bush was really interesting, but you're talking about someone who didn't even finish high school. Same way, I only got lucky and finished high school. I had a wrestling coach come to me and say, listen, you go out for wrestling every year like you've gone for the last 2 years. Don't quit in your junior year like you're saying you're going to do. Quit and start riding. And you will graduate. Get to school at 10 o'clock. Gallop horses in the morning. Come to school at 10 o'clock and go out for wrestling, which I did. Yeah. And he talked me into not quitting. But I was fortunate. I had a guy that took an interest in me and said, listen, don't quit. Get here 10 o'clock. You go out for wrestling. You will graduate. And I graduated, almost by accident. It was strictly by accident. It wasn't on purpose. But I'll never forget what Miller Preston taught me. And I carried those lessons through my life. You know what I told Miller Preston not too long ago? I said, you know what you taught me in geometry? He said, I didn't have you for geometry. I had you for algebra. I said, well, geometry, algebra, it's all the same to me. I said, but you know what you taught me that really helped me get through my life and riding career? He says, what? I said, how not to quit something you're supposed to finish. That's what I carried through my riding career. How not to quit something you're supposed to finish. And he had tears come to his eyes. He's 80 years old. And he says, I never thought of it like that, Tone. He says, that means so much to me. You just hope that guys take care of their future by taking care of their present earnings.
I've had this, this conversation. You've discussed this. I mean, in terms of, and Richie, when he had that program that he ran for a few years in New York, essentially a mentorship program that the jocks, for the jocks, the up and coming, the young kids, I mean, I suppose at some point, you guys always say I give the jock agents too much credit, but I mean, the jock agents should be, looking out for guys as well. I'm sure that that's a spotty, I'm sure that there's no consistency to that. That part of it, educating, especially kids, that. In a lot of cases, probably grew up, without much, and so all of a sudden, when they start making, big money, I mean, this is, even a young journeyman is making good six-figure income that, they can be a little irresponsible.
Yeah, and that's what happens. They make that money at a young age, and it's into the six-figure, especially a successful bug year. When I was riding a successful bug year, you made you 100, 20,000. I think that's what 150,000, 100,000. You know, you hit that 100,000, you stop counting. And then when that's the way it was, you know, and that's in the 70s. And there was guys now that 100,000. The guys that are just making ends meet are making 100,000 now. The way the purse structures are at certain racetracks. I mean, I wrote for $2,500 purses, $3,000 purses. You wrote 3,500 claimers or a beaten $3,000 claimer, and you won the race, and you got $180. You know, $3,000 purse. But now, I mean, you got these purses where these tracks have casinos and the added money, and the lowest purse might be $15,000. And, you know, with us, in the years that I wrote, $15,000 was the feature of the day, and it was probably a two other than or an A other than. And, man, that's $900. Jeez, I really done a good day today. I picked up $900. And the other thing you touched on was agents. There are agents out there that take pride in nurturing a young kid that doesn't know any better. And then there's other people out there that they take pride in seeing how much they can get off of that individual because they know he's not real educated to the game. He's not educated to the expenses and money that he's earning and knowing what to do with it. And I've had an agent one day tell me about when I went and talked to him about a kid, you know, try to help the kid out. He says, well, he's only going to blow it anyway, so I might as well get it. That was one agent's mentality. Then I had another agent. My uncle had the same agent. He wrote for 19 years, and he had the same agent for the whole 19 years, Freddie Snoz Krieger. Snoz, that was his racetrack name, Snoz. But, you know, and Snoz was one of those kind of guys that really took a young kid under his wings. Even after he had my uncle retired, he was still an agent. In fact, he even had my book for a little while before he retired. But he took him under the wing, and he said, listen, you've got to take care of what you're making, Mike. And he impressed upon him, you're not going to make it every day. My uncle, he never got out of high school. And one of the biggest purchases he made, he bought a farm. 180 acres in Marlton. Now, that wasn't because he knew he was a farmer. He didn't even live there after a while. But he developed the land, and he was a real estate connoisseur. He turned real estate over. And Freddie had a big influence on him. You know, buy property in areas that are up and coming before they get there. Buy the property. He sold that farm for what he paid for it. He probably sold it about 20, 30, 40 times more than what he paid for it within 10 years of owning it. I even lived on that farm for a little while till he sold it. I wish my uncle didn't sell that farm. I might have still been there. But that was the influence that he had on him. And there was also some trainers that he wrote for that were good businessmen, you know, and they talked to him. When he rode 19, 20 years, he became a racing official. He didn't even have to be an official. He could make a living. He did it because his reputation was so impeccable that he was sought after to be a steward. And he did that for another 20 years. But, you know, they're the exceptions. You know, I rode with guys and don't even want to mention names that were at the end of their career and they didn't have, I don't want to say it in the way that I would normally talk if you and I were just talking. They didn't have 2 cents to rub together. Yeah. And that's a sad situation.
Yeah.
But you know, the other thing, though, the Guild used to be a not to this day and age. I mean, they still are a positive influence, I hope, on kids. I don't have that much contact with them, so I don't have any more an opinion on what the Guild is doing. But in the day and age of Nick Jemus, he was an old-time rider that was one hell of a businessman. He was a hell of a businessman, and he had a major influence on a lot of riders. But he also used to, with the Guild at the time, you know, when I was in it in the early years, they made sure they provided health insurance. They took so much out for savings out of every jock's mount. You know, they would take a certain amount of money out. I think at one time it was $5, and 3 went to savings and 2 went to health insurance or whatever. I forget. I was the treasurer at that time, but I forget what the exact figures were. But they made sure you had some savings. They made sure that you had health insurance, you know. And then they also made sure that the tracks carried catastrophic injury and accident insurance if you got hurt while performing the duties of a jockey, you know. So Yeah, but there's not a lot out there in this day and age that really protects these kids, and you just hope that the up-and-coming kids that are out there are influenced by the right people, and you also hope that the Guild does have some positive bearing on their present day earnings and their future.
Tony, I want you to do an exercise here for everybody, because I can't remember the last time we did this, and I just pulled up your career, and for those that are curious, Tony it's 50 years, but the horses that Tony rode are responsible for $63,655,000 in earnings. $63 million. Tony, your best year was 2002, which is interesting, actually. And the earnings, the purse earnings of your mounts, call it $4.5 million. And explain to everybody how that gets broken out, how that's distilled down, you know, and we could pick a purse or, you know, just pick $100,000 stake, and how the jock, after everything gets netted out, what you get out of a win. And of course, we also should explain to everybody that the structure for wins versus the structure for second and third, and right, and then what is ostensibly just a jock's mount, because you don't just take the earnings and say, oh, well, he must have made 10% of all of that. No, that's not how it works.
No, right off the bat, when you're riding races, the one thing that is constant is your jock's mount, and the jock's mount over the years has changed. You know, I can remember when I rode a $25 jocks mount, 10% for win, and purses over a certain mount, you got $50 for second, and just jocks mount down for third, fourth, and anything else. But that's changed over the years. Where a jock, let's say it's a $100,000 stake, the jockey will get 10% of the 60%. So $100,000, the 60%, of course, is $60,000 to the winning horse, and you'll get 10% of the $60,000. So you picked up $6,000 for winning the stake. Now, it used to be at one point they could get second money was, you know, which would be 20% of that, which would be $20,000. You give you $50. You know, you got $50. That was for second. Third, you just got that third place back, you just got the jock's mount, which maybe was $35 or $50 for a stake. But then that changed over the years, and I guess it was in the late 90s, you know, we started to say we want to get a percentage, and maybe it was even before the late, maybe it was earlier than that. I'm not exactly sure of. But we said, wait a minute, we want 10% across the board. And and these tracks we organized. And, you know, and the Guild was behind us, and we wound up not getting 10% across the board. We kept the 10% of the 60%, and then we settled for 5% for second and 5% for third.
Right,
It made some sense. You're getting a percentage of second and third money, you know, it was big money. And so you got a percentage of that on purses that were bigger than the jock's mount, and we had jock's mount increased to $100. You know, you went from $25, $35 to $100 jock's mount, which that was a big increase. $100 jock's mount, 10% for winning, 5% for second, 5% for third. And that was important. That started really affecting earnings in a real positive way. I mean, you know how many times you rode on purses that were bigger than $15,000 or $20,000, and you just got the you know, $50 for second and jock's mount back. That was it. So that was a big move. And it was met with a lot of resistance. You know, it wasn't like, oh, yeah, we'll go up and heartily give it to you. You know, we went and had to sit down. Some tracks maybe were, and some jurisdictions were more favorable to it. It was a battle at a lot of tracks. Philadelphia Park, I guess it was, or Keystone at the time. I forget what the name of the track was, but you know the track. You know, we had to really organize and stick together. And then we had riders that just, which we called them scabs, that rode. When we went out, they rode. So they took and made it even harder for us to get that 10, 5, and 5% and $100 jobs now. You know, because they figure, well, I'll capitalize on, I'm not doing real good, but I'll capitalize on you heavy head riders, you successful riders, by riding, because once you get this, if you get it, you know, I'm going to be back to galloping horses and riding a few horses here or there. So it was a shame. And I'm not going to mention names, but the whole thing about it was those guys that were rallied against us and rode against us. You know what? After they wound up, after the thing got resolved, whatever they made in that period of time, maybe they thought it was a success story for them. But they were labeled, and they were not really thought well of. And a few of them, you know, time wears on. Sometimes things are forgotten, and eventually it goes away. But I wouldn't have wanted to have been labeled a scab, because it followed you for many years. But it was always a battle for riders to get more. You know, when I first started riding, that had just gone into place, that they were paid. You were paid through the office. You know, what your agent used to do, when my uncle was riding, and most of his career probably till he retired, near the end it was probably in place, but your agent had to go collect your money, and the only thing that you were maybe guaranteed was jocks mount. If he didn't want to pay you the 10%, you know, a guy could say, you screwed the last two races up for me, I'm going to give you your jocks mount, and maybe I'll give you $50. It was a collection. That's where your agent really had to know the people that he was working, you were working for, you know, and he'd keep you out of those situations. But there was trainers that just reneged on paying a rider other than jocks mount, which was probably $25 at the time. They go, you know, it was an agent's job to get your money. And that's why the agents, when I know when I first started riding, it went, the fee went from 20% to 25%, and it was off of your earnings, but not your gross earnings. What are your net? It was after jocks mount, after they took out guild fees. Agents would say, no, you're going to pay me before they take out these guild fees, you know. And it was a different game, and it transitioned into the game that it is today, which riders are fortunate enough to ride for bigger money and bigger purses, and it's all through the office. You don't need your agent to go collect it. You know, the biggest thing you have going for you is you have good communication with your agent, so you can maybe fill him in on what horses, if you've been riding and they come up against each other, which one you want to ride before he screws it up. But, you know, the agent relationship is totally different than what it was when my uncle was riding. And it was totally different, you know, for me, from when my uncle was riding. The first few years I rode, I kept the same agent. After a while, they became disposable. I had 13 different agents in the years that I rode. And some of it was because I changed areas, and some of it was because they became stagnant or less effective, and I got some fresh attitude by getting an agent that was excited to be part of my riding, you know. So we changed. They got complacent, I changed. And other things, the reason they changed is I went to different areas. You know, when I rode in Chicago, I took an agent that was out there, local, that was familiar with the people.
Yeah.
I had big tricky Dick Fisher. You know, he was a stable agent for Lassiter and Vance, and he became a jocks agent. He when they disposed of that outfit, he said, how about if I go to work for you? And you couldn't get a better guy. That guy I stuck with to the end, near the end.
Oh,
but I had also, you know who else I had as an agent? He was a character. Henry Block. And Henry Block was a rider that had a terrible reputation as a rider, but he was a good agent because he knew horses. In fact, Henry's brother, John Block, was a jockey. And, you know, I brought it up the other day. Do you know who rode Kelso in the first start of his life? That was Henry's brother, John Block.
Wow.
That's something that would be situation that you'd be bragging about, but he didn't stay on him. But his first start, I think he won it, and John Block was on him.
Jesus, that's not even a name. Not a name that I absolutely can recall even noting in a anywhere, Tony. In fact, I don't even think that it doesn't even come up under a jockey search. How about that? So the stats must be. When did he retire? Well, Case, you lost Tony. Yeah, I think we lost Tony. Here, I've got, as it happens.
Oh, here we are.
There we go.
Me back. Yeah, I guess it was in the late 60s when he retired. He took my book in the early 70s, I guess.
Okay.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. And I guess he, in the 70s, he became an agent. I was probably one of his first writers. And you know, he was a hustler. He didn't have a good reputation as a writer. But, you know, I only wrote a limited amount of time with him, and I never saw him doing anything wrong. But his reputation as a writer was he was out of business as an older writer. So when he, his trust level was minimal.
Well, here it is.
A good agent. He was a good agent.
There it is. I never had noticed that before. Jay Block, the first two starts of Kelso's career, and of course Carl Hanford, and those starts came. His first three career starts came in Atlantic City.
Yeah, no, Kelso, John Block, but his brother Henry rode quite a bit. You know, John didn't ride all that long, I don't believe. Henry was about a 20-year rider, you know, and his other brother, Carl Block, was, he's too big to be a jockey, fortunately, but he never became a jockey, but he became an agent, and he was a top agent in this Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland area. Anybody that had Carl Block, you went after, got him as an agent. But I got his brother Henry.
Tony, you're going to love this. Chuck Balthazar just texted me, and he said, Henry Block's famous saying was, Would I lie to you?
Would I lie? Chuck knows. I was with Chuck in Merlin years ago. Yeah, that was Henry. Would I lie? That was his favorite expression. And he would rather lie than tell the truth, even if it didn't make any difference to him. He just got excited when it came to telling a falsehood.
Well, there's a couple of people around the racetrack now that the expression that lies to keep in practice.
Yeah, it was just a lifestyle for Henry. Chuck, he was around in New Jersey and Maryland, rode with him. Yeah, I rode with him, but I never paid much attention to what he did on horses. But as an agent, he was a good agent. And that Would I Lie came in handy when he was an agent handling trainers and trying to get on the best horse and getting off the one that he was on. I think he only got taken to the stewards for taking off of a first call a couple times.
Too funny. Oh, my God.
Yeah. There's a lot of characters in this business, you know, and Henry was definitely one of those guys that would be, the guy that used to write about the writer? I can't think of his name, but he was a guy that would have been in this author's books because he was such a character, you know. I can't think of the guy's name on the author.
The mystery the
wrote
British
a lot about, he wrote a lot about racetrack.
Oh my god, yeah. Well, the now see, I had it and now it's gonna flit out of my head.
Yeah, me too. I'm sorry I brought it up because I can't finish it.
Oh my god, that's bad.
Yeah,
but I don't know if this is who you mean though. With Dick Francis.
Dick Francis.
You did mean Dick Francis. Okay.
Francis. Yeah.
All right.
Dick Francis novels. Yeah. Henry would have been in one of them.
Oh, Tony, this was. I'm glad. That's funny. I didn't. You know, we're trying to turn a difficult situation into into a conversation. And in fact, the update regarding Jose Mejias, that you know, he had apparently a very tough day yesterday, as he, you know, fights against the situation, but. It's very hard. It can happen. You know, everybody at a young age, you know, you come on to this and you just think you're invincible and
yeah,
you know, your body could never betray you in a somehow in a circumstance, a accident, but. You know, it's a constant. Even if you are 100% focused, it still can change in an instant. So it pays to be prudent and be responsible.
You know, yes, Steve. You know, when I think back to riding and all the years that I rode, and then I rode with guys like my little cousin Sam. He's paraplegic. I rode with Rick Wilson, had a severe head injury, and you know.
Yep.
And guys like that, and I rode with other guys that, you know, lived a lifestyle that was a little too fast, and you know, they're younger than me, and they're not even here. And I could list the name of guys, I'm not even going to go through it, but guys that their lifestyle didn't register. You know, you got to slow down when it comes to your lifestyle. I was fortunate, you know, I see where there's people and there's jockeys that are facing situations even in this day and age that, you know, they're not young guys, but they're older guys. There's jock in California that's dealing with lifestyle. And I don't know, but I don't even want to mention name.
But, yeah, I hear you.
But they're dealing with a lifestyle that it hasn't registered. Do you want a future? I was lucky. I finally, in the first 20 years of the end, I always look at my career as 40 years riding as two careers. The first 20 years started out gangbusters and ended up in disgrace. You know, when I got clean and sober in December 15th, 1990, and, you know, quit the drinking, went through the rehab at Havity Grass, Maryland. Havity Grass. Father Martin's Ashley. And I never went to Havity Grass as a racetrack, but I went to Havity Grass to get clean and sober. Father Martin's Ashley. And that career, that started my second 20-year career in 1990, which lasted till better than, just a little more than 20 years. It started out slow, and it ended up at least a career where I could look at people and ended it up with some level of respect. Won a bunch of races, you know, but I didn't base my whole career and life on winning races. I based my future on staying clean and sober. And I hope that people are facing these traumas and traumatic situations of insobriety and poor lifestyle. If you want a future, you gotta change your present. If you want a future, you got to get clean and sober. That's the only thing that I can say that gave me a future was putting the cocaine and the straw down and stop snorting and stop drinking. That's what gave me a future. And that's what will give anybody a future. You got to get clean and you got to get sober. Put the drugs and alcohol away and you will have a future. And I just can't say that enough to people that are facing these problems today. You want a future? Get clean.
Tony, that's a great way to wrap up the visit. And as always, everybody has such respect and appreciation for what you've accomplished and continue to do. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Steve, and I have such respect and appreciation for all you do for the racing industry and how you portray it and the word you put out there. Thank you, brother Steve, and I love you.
Love you, Tony. Be well, and we'll catch up next week. Tony Black, everybody, and an absolute star from the day he joined us and goes back to literally the day one of At the Races, the entire run. back in July of 05. And thanks to Chuck Baltazar, too. And Chuck, I know Chuck listens out there in the desert, and I appreciate it. I got to get Chuck back on the show too. That's talk about not just his career, but what he's doing now with horses and art, and got a great. He's got himself a nice post racetrack life going. Sean Clancy's never going to leave the racetrack life.
Is that good or bad? Good morning.
It's hard to say. I went on a rant earlier, Sean, and in part because I sense the critics of the game and of the industry. The attacks when they come. They really don't have a perspective or an understanding of what the racetrack is really, and what this is not a 9-to-5. It's not a job. You get in the car and you go to it, and when you leave, you go back to the family. It's a lifestyle, and maybe it's one of the reasons that the sport, suffers. It is something of an anachronistic endeavor, and maybe that's why it the perception of it and the comprehension of what's involved is so unclear and just not easy.
It's a good point. I mean, look, we for any of us that grew up in it, we spent every holiday dealing with the horses, and my brother and I remember getting up Christmas morning, and we'd go by the Christmas tree, and we could take a look in there, see what was under the tree, and then we'd go to Delaware Park and go feed the horses and get everything, or the farm or wherever we were going. I mean, we did that every Christmas, so. It's 24/7. If you're involved with the horses, if you're taking care of them, our little farm here in Virginia, we had a horse get colic, came up colic on, what day was that? I mean, that was Saturday morning. My wife and I, my son Miles, we were going to go, and we had unhooked the truck and unhooked the truck from the trailer. We're going to go. Go to a little town 30 minutes from here. We're going to go look for some antique doors for the new renovation project in the house. So that's what you're planning on doing on the day. And, we're about to leave, and I get a call from a guy who works for us. And says, Game Boy, he's a big warm blood show horse, but Game Boy's not acting right. So I take off running, run down there, and sure enough, Game Boy's rolling, and he's colicky, he ain't acting right. He called the vet, and we sit there all day with him, and the vet, if we took him to the clinic. You're just struggling every minute. You think, what should he take him to the clinic? Should he not take him to the clinic? Is he gonna be okay? We're walking him, and you're doing everything for him, and take him to the clinic. That was Saturday, afternoon, 4 o'clock or something. Take him there, and. You live and breathe phone calls all week to see how Game Boy's doing. And we went and picked him up last night at the clinic, and he seems to be fine. I went out this morning and grazed him in the pouring rain because he needs grass, but you can't turn him out. He's not allowed grain. So, you got to stand outside in the pouring rain and graze Game Boy, hoping he's recovered and hoping he's going to be okay. So. And that's my story, but that's what everybody's, that anybody in our game who's working in it, is living it, is dealing with the same thing every day. And it's all consuming. And we not that I really care about antique doors, but we've yet to go and look for antique doors. That was about a week. Miles is pretty funny. I said, I said, well, that was a ruined Saturday, huh, buddy? And he goes, well, Dad, we were going antiquing. I said, yeah, at least we weren't. You know, we have a baseball game or something interesting to do. We laugh, you know. But yeah, that's what everybody's dealing with. I mean, it's just you know, what you deal with every day. And, you know, my story is just it's no different than anybody else's story that's working in the sport. You're just trying every day to keep all the horses healthy and happy. And unfortunately, look, there's some outliers. There's some, you know, we've seen it. There's spotlights on some you know, real negativity of our game. And, you know, we've got to clean that up. We got to straighten that out. And, you know, we're facing a crisis. The focus is on it. Technology today, the negative stories have a way of getting around faster than anything else. And, you know, horse racing, we're on our back foot for sure. We're not doing a very good job of getting those messages across. I know that.
Well, and actually this touches on what I, you know, what I was screeding about earlier. And actually, we're going to have at the HPPA convention in March at Oaklawn, doing the moderating on a panel with, you know, racing official, owner, horseman, nice variety. And essentially, the topic is stewardship and what it's supposed to entail. And you know, this all gets back to that message from last year, the end of last year, that I was espousing, was essentially the, you know, cultivate your own garden. And that, you know, if everybody in their own discipline and in their own environment has a consciousness and are governed and guided by the principle of being a good steward of the game in whatever you're doing, then that, you know, that essentially solves a big percentage of problems that, you know, seem to crop up on a regular basis. I mean, and you can't, obviously, Sean, you can't legislate people's morality. I mean, if somebody has larceny in their heart, and that's their guiding, you know, their guiding principle, you know, we're at their mercy when they make choices that embarrass and, you know, paint the game in a bad light.
No question, and that's something we're you know, that's an impossible task to achieve that, because yeah, you're trying to you can't legislate morality. You can't you know, one person's morality, conscience, or whatever you want to call it, is different than another's. You know, look, we see it. I mean, I go back to steeplechasing. That, you know, there's people in flat racing who think steeplechasing is barbaric and inhumane and shouldn't do it and everything else. And if you looked at it, you just think, okay, let's take a bigger view of this and realize that this is how mainstream society thinks of flat racing. You know, so if you look at it that way, you go, wait a minute, you know, because, you know, I think it's okay to run horses over jumps and somebody else doesn't. You need to stop and take a look at it and consider it. And I think that's really important, because flat racing is trying to go to the mainstream, the real world out there, and say, we're fighting for our lives to say this is okay. And a lot of people don't understand it and don't agree with it and don't want it. And for all the reasons, there's so much more pressure on it now because of that. But, you know, we're taking a very, flat racing's taking a pretty narrow view to steeplechasing. And I'm fine with that. I understand that. I'm not saying everybody should want to be in steeplechasing. But if you stop and look at it's not that as flat racing is marginalizing steeplechasing, flat racing is being marginalized from the real world, and you need to look at it, and you need to think about it. And I think that goes for all horse disciplines, all aspects of this sport. I mean, it's to look down your nose at another sport with a horse or not understand or not appreciate it, not respect it, is very narrow-minded, you need to look at it that way when you're trying to get people to understand your sport. Show jumping shouldn't be knocking eventing, three-day eventing, because it's they think it's too dangerous. Everybody needs to work together and try to figure out a way forward. We're in a tricky spot for sure. I mean, the negativity out there is it's never. I mean, thoroughbred racing has never faced this kind of crisis, I don't think, in history. So, I don't know. We need to figure out how to go forward and try to, you got to be a custodian of it. You got to be a steward of it. And I think everybody's trying to do that pretty well. I mean, I justify whether it's right or wrong, but I know steeplechasing is a dangerous sport, but I honestly can say I think the sport's better off for me being involved in the sport. I think horses as a whole are better off because I was involved in the sport than if I wasn't. And I think that's how I look at it. And I think that's if you look at it that way, if everybody in the sport, if you can honestly say that horses are better off because I am involved, then that's a pretty good barometer of how you should be going about your business and how you should be handling the sport.
And it's funny that when you reference the negative tones, and I referenced you a little bit because you have told me repeatedly when you see me or talk to me, whether it's on air or off, and I'm bothered by and worked up over this kind of scenario where it just I find it really disheartening and just debilitating to go forward and have a continence of an upbeat continence on a day-to-day basis when there's just people hurling one brick and one Molotov cocktail after another essentially and creating constant conflict and negativity and I very frequently pull myself up and say, well, remember what Sean said, just because they have a keyboard, it doesn't make, what they're saying, relevant or correct or, worth considering. But the issue, I mean, to some degree is that, you've got people that are impressionable, Sean, that are seeing that those refrains and the echoing, because it is an echo chamber in a lot of cases, and so that's their that's their impression. So I mean, for those that are trying to encourage people to consider betting, encouraging people to consider ownership, encouraging people to consider breeding, well, when they wade into it and this is what they're encountering and the waves it's like when you go to Hawaii and the waves come crashing in on you and the undertow will drag you out and drown you and so you either run for the shore or you go ahead and swim and take it on. But it's an atmosphere that is very difficult to to be encouraging, and that that is the part that I find frustrating, and just a path forward against that is my is my concern. The problems as they exist are all solvable, and you know, will be solved. But you know, you can't stop the negative impressions to me. I mean, that am I wrong, or am I doing what you told me not to do?
No, look, it's a good point. I've tried to articulate before, and I find it hard to articulate. But the social media presence, to me, Twitter is a place where I think you have to be very careful thinking that Twitter is the majority opinion or the people's, that is. Yeah, I think you want to be really careful because Twitter's set up now. I know it's set up, but anymore it is so designed for negative bent and negative slant on something. So I don't think you can look at that as the reality of a situation, because the negative voice is so much louder than the positive voice, simply because you can't possibly even go on there and say something positive or contend. You know, if you go on there and try to refute someone's negative opinion of something, mm-hmm. man, it goes south so fast, and then you're fighting for your life and trying to defend yourself, and people are Correct. Attacking you and attacking your business. And I mean, I've done it. I mean, I've fallen into it. I made a few. I mean, I'd be really careful trying not to put something negative on there. And you easily can. And I think you want to be really careful. But the most important part is to realize that might not be the majority opinion. It's the majority opinion of a very negative. A very negative platform. I know, like, I promise you, I was at, it taught me so much about social media. I was helping at the Virginia Falls Steeplechase, which is Glenwood Park. It's 2 miles up the road from where I live in Middleburg. And I was volunteered. I'm on the board. So I'm out there on a Friday, Miles and I, and we're stapling name tags to post for the tailgates. And we're out there. This is probably 4 or 5 years ago. The sun was going down. I mean, it is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been in my life. And I look across, and I walk up to the top of the steward stand. I take a picture. Sun's going down over the Blue Ridge Mountains. I mean, it is absolute gorgeous, right? And I think I put it on Facebook, maybe Twitter. I forget which. But I put on there, I said the most beautiful view in racing, something like that, right? In a matter of minutes, I had people saying, "Oh, I guess you've never been to Santa Anita. I bet you the people at Far Hills would beg to differ. Oh, what about you've never been to Queens Cup? I guess Sarah's." I'm going, "Holy cow!" Like, and what I should have written is beautiful view from a racetrack. That's what I should have written, or anything like that. No, I wrote the most beautiful view in racing, and I had morons on Twitter and Facebook asking me, "I guess you've never been to Saratoga." I go, "Oh my God, how did I get here?" And it just went, it just ran off the tracks, and I thought, where are we living? What? This is insanity. And that's society. That's where we're living today. It's insanity. Like, and people are so quick to just want to argue something. I'm like, I wasn't starting a contest of. There was no award. There was no cash prize to say the most beautiful view. Where's the most beautiful view in racing? I'm like, I just gave up. I'm like, oh my God! And so you realize you have to be really to try to phrase something on there. Anyway, scary. I mean, it's not scary. It's just concerning to realize that that's what you're dealing with in today's world.
You've neutralized it at least on Facebook with your pictures that are just labeled farm art.
Farm art. Exactly. Right. You notice I don't say the most beautiful farm in the world. I just write farm art, take it or leave it. I'm not saying it's any better than anybody else's farm art. It's just my farm art, and if it makes you smile and you have a laugh and you see a cool picture, I hope you like it. That's all I'm going for. I'm not saying it's the most. All the world, believe me. And I'm not saying I'm the best artist and the best photographer. My iPhone isn't even that good. It's just the middle of the road. I'm just saying, here's some farm art. Enjoy it.
So America's most majestic racetrack goat. That doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you never seen Mr. Man?
Exactly. I promise you, I'm kidding around about it, but I'm serious. I mean, it did teach me a lot about the social media forum, in that people immediately want to. It's just I don't know what it is. I don't know why or how, but it has an immediate argument trigger, and it's just people, they just instantly want to argue with you, and I fall into it too. Maybe I'm doing the same thing, I don't know, but I do know that day at Glenwood Park, I certainly was not, I mean, it wouldn't even cross my mind that I was trying to say this view was better than your view, or this view of this little racetrack up, little hunt meet up the street from where I live is better than your little racetrack around the corner. It's not what I was going for. I thought people would enjoy it, and plenty of people looked at it. But the amount of people that quickly just started a argument or started a confrontation, it was like, wow.
Well, I'm glad they didn't see that Christmas tree of yours fall out of the back of the truck.
Man, that day, I actually probably could have got away with that day. I probably could have said the best Christmas tree to ever fall off the back of a truck. I probably could have got away with that. And actually, I don't. Could anybody have argued that?
It's hard to say.
I couldn't say most beautiful Christmas tree, because obviously you ran away with that. No, it's not as good as my Christmas tree. Have you seen my Christmas tree? Right. I probably could have said the most beautiful, majestic, iconic Christmas tree to fall off the back of a truck. I probably could have got away with that.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and your picture of the poor, sad Charlie Brown Christmas tree. I'm talking about confrontation on social media. You put that out there. Look at the Christmas tree. Trying to win some. There wasn't a cash prize on the most beautiful Christmas tree that day. What were you going for?
I was going for laughs. I was going for cheap laughs. That's my that's my raison d'etre.
You were going for clickbait or whatever.
The clickbait. There you go.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Killing me. Throwing me on that. I'm walking down the street, and they're like, "I can't believe you! That was your that Christmas tree. That's embarrassing." Oh my God. Appreciate that, Steve. Good old Steve Beck. Appreciate that. And his wintergreen spray bottle. Silver Christmas tree that's now in the closet.
It is, actually. It comes apart in three parts, and she got this very cool new thing. She got this Christmas tree storage system that came. It's hysterical, and the thing is,
I have one too. I have a 30-acre farm. That's my storage. Yeah, birds actually live in mine. Yeah.
Oh my God! The storage system—that's great.
Storage unit for Christmas tree.
A box came, little box. I opened it up, and it was all these extracts. Additives that she puts into the humidifier, and you know, the lavender and there it was, wintergreen.
Perfect.
Right?
Perfect.
People come in the house. Oh, your tree smells so good. Fooled another one.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, God.
It's all right.
All right, before we go, oh, my God. What'd you make of this weekend? Knicks go and life is good.
I thought life is good would win. So I mean, I kind of think the fresh horse is the Pegasus. You just want a little bit of a fresher horse than the horse that's coming to the tail end of a long year or long career. It was over in a matter of strides. I kept reading that Knicks go because of the post position had an advantage. I didn't see that. So life is good, obviously very good. I thought in 10 strides, I said, this is over. I think everybody did. He's a nice horse, obviously. That was good. It was good racing. That was a good card down there for sure. Now we just got to see what comes up next, I guess.
It's unusual. I mean, you've been around Todd a long time. It's a little unusual to hear him kind of gush over a horse like this and put him in, you know, in elite, obviously elite company.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's hard to get him. It's hard to get him. I mean, he will actually say to you does this horse remind you of anybody? And he always will say, I don't like to compare horses, and they never rank a horse or compare a horse. So that was pretty bullish words for sure. It's pretty hard to argue that he wouldn't be one of the best horses he's ever had off of that performance. I mean, he's got that high cruising speed, definitely gets the trip. He's pretty lightly raced, really. I mean, he's got should have plenty of races in him now. He's a serious horse. I don't know how anybody else thought about it, but I thought he was a certainty in there personally. I just didn't. I've obviously always liked Nick's go. He's a cool horse, but I don't know, for whatever reason, I just felt that I think a fresh horse in the Pegasus just seems like a big advantage to those horses that have had long careers . I don't like this horse. It's the last race of a long career. I mean, I don't know, against a horse that might be a little fresher, it might be still climbing the ladder a little bit.
Though that's been the absolute storyline in this race year after year, that there's been the emergent, on the upswing, fresh face, the it horse, as it were.
No, exactly. I mean, I don't think the Breeders' Cup was meant to always be the crescendo, the finale, and then when you add a race like the Pegasus, I think you have to keep that in mind when you're analyzing it, that it's a strange. I mean, it's a different type race at a different time of year. I think it does lend itself to a horse that's fresher and younger and just kind of go on the up, on the upswing rather than maybe on the downswing.
Sean, speaking of upswings, we're inching closer to, another every day you pull the calendar page off and you look up at the beautiful thisishorseracing.com calendar, and in fact I've got to turn and reach for, I think I haven't turned the fe- no I haven't I got to I've got
hey,
to turn.
Days behind, buddy.
I am days behind. Let me, well, I am a huge Groundhog Day in a big way here, but I was a little put out.
Do you have a tree for that? Do you have a Groundhog Day tree?
Groundhog Day tree.
You got a fake groundhog you pull out of the closet and set up, huh?
I've got the one from Caddyshack, the dancing gopher from Caddyshack. I'm all right. Domestic spending is the This Is Horse Racing calendar poster horse.
All right. No, it's good. Look, February in our game, you're getting closer to the spring. That's all I think anybody, and certainly when you own a farm or you're in the Mid-Atlantic, anywhere north, you're just counting the days to spring. you know, that's, yeah, that's what I'm going for. It's just, you know, all the horses are back jogging, nothing's going wrong, they're back going. So you're just, you know, you're kind of just trying not to think about it too much, just trying to, these are good, you know, it's good, important time of the year for our horses because you're kind of building up to it, and very long, slow work, and, yeah, you just count down the days till March, April, and you'll be back on the road and back in the swing of things.
Exactly. Well, not just a farm, but the most beautiful farm in the Chesapeake.
Exactly. Most beautiful, the best pygmy goat in the absolute world, and the best planted Christmas trees that's ever in any part of the world. It's got the best. I'm looking at two old retirees in the front field. They're the best retirees anybody's ever retired.
Sean Clancy, everybody, always great. And you follow Sean on Twitter, by Sean Clancy. And I see that, as always, we've resonated. Melissa Nolan, famed keen gal, says the story is going to live in infamy, Sean. This is this is actually, I think, has replaced the car keys as
right up there. I'll trot the car keys story out again. Don't worry.
All right. You get the car keys. I get the Christmas tree.
That's the deal.
Sean Clancy, everybody. Sean, thank you. I will catch up in about 3 weeks, depending on Tom and Tom Law and your brother. Your brother is working Your brother's working with the IT people right now.
Yeah, evidently. I don't know what he's doing, but yeah, hopefully they're doing something useful, more useful than what I'm doing today.
Well, go out there and make some farm art for us.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks, Sean.
It's a great work.
So much fun. Sean Clancy, everybody, lifting the mood. Let's take a break, our last break, second of the morning. Rob Masiello is going to join us. And Rob, if you didn't see his thread, I tried to call attention to it last night and then again this morning, and I even gave you the Thread Reader app version where, you know, you can read the whole thread without going from post to post. But Rob is trying to figure out the source of the income, the handle, that the little, you know, the blips and the boost that we've seen. And we've got a bunch of people on the case. Rob, absolutely as good as anybody to do it. Paul Matisse has been reacting to it and sending me some notes, and Maury Wolf as well. And Maury is going to have some thoughts too once he kind of digs through. There's a lot of things at work here. Should be very interesting. And appreciate Rob visiting next to flesh it out. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.